Deep in the ocean, an orca pod is on the hunt. But these aren't your average orcas. These guys are organized.
Marketing team, did you get those social media posts scheduled for the seal migration?
Aye, aye, Captain. We even have an automated notification for all pod managers when they go live.
They use Monday.com to keep their teamwork sharp, their communication clear, and their goals in sight. Monday.com, for whatever you run, even orcas. Go to Monday.com to dive deeper.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
So the response to these AI remixes has been, among the fans, very positive. Even Little John liked it. Questlove says, I should not be laughing this hard at 1 a.m. So the fans liked it. The record labels, however, not so much. Many of the songs you just saw were stricken from the internet. I got more copyright strikes than I can count, and takedowns, and it got so bad, particularly from Universal Music Group, that I had to take my YouTube channel down for 3 months just to let all these strikes expire so I didn't get a permanent ban. I could give a whole other presentation on how YouTube makes it virtually impossible to overturn a strike based on parody and fair use, which should be protecting a lot of these songs, but basically they can't afford to upset the labels, so they do whatever the labels say.
It's the Yukon Popcast, and recently Yukon Center for the Study of Popular Music hosted a panel discussion on artificial intelligence and the future of music. The panel featured Dr. Mitchell Green, Professor of Philosophy at the University of Connecticut, Dustin Ballard, a musician and creator of the social media channel There I Ruined It, and Dr. Aaron Dial, a postdoctoral research fellow at the Humanities and Technoscience Lab at Purdue University. The panel was moderated by Professor Jeffrey Ogbar, who directs the Center for the Study of Popular Music. And so, I give you AI and the future of music.
I want to welcome everyone first off. My name is Jeffrey Ogbar. I'm director of the Center for the Study of Popular Music and professor of history. And the center has, each semester, we do one event, and we have sometimes brown bag lunches, we have high school students that come up, we bring speakers in. We have this opportunity today to have multiple speakers in a panel, a very exciting topic, artificial intelligence and music. As many of us are aware, we have this incredible innovation that this technology may be game-changing in every arena of life, from healthcare to journalism to how we understand the law and execute policy, writing, even scholarship. So we think about the utility of artificial intelligence, and some people, as we'd expect, have great caution and some trepidation about what AI might be for society. And when we think about all the applications of AI, pop culture, music, has found its way in the discussions as well. Some of us are familiar with the strike last year in Hollywood with writers and actors. And so Hollywood in our entertainment, whether we're talking about film or TV, has already manifested itself in the sort of challenges and fears. And when we think about music, we're seeing that as well. So 2 days ago, you may have seen that over 200 musicians have signed a document saying that they have concerns about AI and their intellectual property. It's quite exciting to see new technologies and the sort of gifts that they offer. And today we'll get a chance to have greater conversations around it. I have a quote here from that 2 days ago, this document signed by over 200 artists saying that AI has enormous potential to advance human activity. And when we think about human activity, we're talking about a very broad way, as many of the ways I mentioned earlier. So today's conversation, we hope to have a robust conversation about AI. We will have a conversation from different perspectives. I'll introduce everyone, but first I'd like to thank our many co-sponsors who made this happen. We have the Popular Culture Initiative from the Humanities Institute at UConn, the African American Cultural Center, College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, and American Studies. This event brings together people from different parts of campus. We're very excited that we could have so many participants and friends. Of the three panelists, we will go in order of my introductions to them. I will introduce all three, but they will go in order after Dr. Mitchell Green, I introduced first, colleague of ours here at UConn. He is a professor of philosophy. His current research interests include evolutionary biology of communication, speech acts and their role in conversation, empathy, self-knowledge, self-expression, attitude ascription. Widely cited and a very prominent figure, and we're really excited to have him weigh into our conversations. We have also Aaron Dial. And UConn, we're all in March Madness right now, right? We have our brackets. And don't hold this against him that he got his degree from North Carolina State. So North Carolina State and UConn, first time in the history of NCAA basketball with a men's team and the women's teams are in the Final Four. UConn will prevail. It's unfortunate for him, but we're happy that he's here. We'll still give him a Husky welcome. He earned his PhD from North Carolina State in communication, rhetoric, and digital media, the program where his expertise is in materialist and digital media studies, digital humanities, black studies, cultural studies of technology and race. He's currently working on his first monograph entitled Dead Stock, A Philosophy of Sneakers and Materiality in the Afterlife of Black Bodies. And last but not least, we have someone, this is all panelists are very exciting and are exciting in their work. And this particular panelist in my social media feed, I get all kind of stuff on music all the time, right? So the algorithm sort of understands that I appreciate music and I'm getting all this stuff. And then I got this really cool reel on Baby Got Back and was it Elvis or? There was an Elvis singer, Baby Got Back, right? And I was absolutely fascinated by it. And then I went through this reel and I became a follower. And I had no idea that I was one of 6 million followers of this this content creator. And I was amazed at the application of AI with creating these new songs. The technology is fascinating. We're learning a whole lot about this. This is Dustin Ballard. He's a musician and advertising creative director in Dallas, Texas. In 2020, so not that long ago, he created the social media channel There I Ruined It, featuring unsung, unusual song remixes and mashups. The channel now has over 6 million followers. His innovative AI creations have been highlighted on numerous news outlets, radio stations, and a congressional hearing. So we're very excited to have Mr. Ballard here as well. So we'll start with Dr. Green, and then each panelist will finish, and then we will have a conversation following the final presentation by Mr. Ballard. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the kind introduction and the generous introduction, and it's an honor to be part of this conversation, and I look forward to learning from my co-panelists as well as everybody in the audience. So thanks very much for being here. Can you all hear me okay? I'm trying to get recording, but I've had a small cold, so I'm sounding a little bit froggy. So especially if you're in the back and you may find my voice tapering off, just say louder again, and I'll know what you mean. All right, so I thought it would be appropriate, given my background, my interests, given the kind of work I've done in aesthetics, to try to lay a little bit of sort of conceptual foundations for the discussion I'd like to have, and maybe that will be helpful once we get more into the sort of weeds of the AI-generated music scene with the other speakers who know a lot more about it than I do. So just if you would take the first slide, please. So I want to do a little bit of throat clearing about the nature of artificial intelligence. I think I can move this a little bit. Can I move this without causing grave damage to your technology? But not too far, it sounds like. So I won't be opening the door if someone knocks. How about that? So, and if you would do it again. So I want to tell you a little bit about the whole concept of artificial intelligence. Just think about the way we use this language. We say things like, well, artificial eggs or leather or wood are not kinds of eggs or leather or wood. Therefore, again, please. Saying that a machine has an AI, is an AI, prejudges that kind of intelligence as less than genuine, because artificial eggs are not types of eggs. They're substitutes. They're not as good. So I'm not saying that artificial intelligence, if it were a real thing, would be better or equal to, but we just shouldn't let the language prejudge things in one way or the other. Again, please, Aaron. A better term, I think, it might be cultured intelligence. Think about how we talk about cultured marble, cultured diamond, cultured meats, cultured diamonds or meat. Those can be real meat or diamonds, et cetera. So I prefer to use that term. And when I, go ahead, please. When I talk about, I'll just back up. Intelligence, whether cultured or naturally evolved, requires having at least some of the following characteristics, I would say. Cognition, things like beliefs and memories. Conation, that's an old medieval term referring to things like intentions, plans, objectives. Affect, emotions or moods. And experiences, sometimes referred to by philosophers as phenomenology or qualia. And I'm just doing a little bit of philosophy of mind that I think is part of a background for thinking about artificial intelligence. Next, please. It's doubtful, at least at this point, that any currently existing machines that we might call AIs or CIs, as I prefer, have intelligence in this sense. But we should keep the question open unless we find that in principle barriers. And in principle barrier that prevents it from being the case that there could ever be a machine that has intelligence in any of the above senses that's there, I doubt it. I certainly haven't seen any good reason that's convinced me of that being the case. So I'm still going to use the term AI, but please know that I really mean CI, cultured intelligence, and I want to remain neutral on the question whether any machines could in the future have intelligence of a genuine kind, even if it's produced by human beings. I don't think we have any now, but that might just be an historically contingent fact. So let me also say a little bit about more aesthetics specifically. I've done a little bit of philosophy of mind. Now some aesthetics, if you would give me the first bit. So many of you will recognize Marcel Duchamp's famous urinal, a urinal that was submitted to an art exhibition. And after lots of controversy and scratching of heads and tearing of garments and so forth, it has been accepted by the art world as a genuine work of art, even though it's a urinal that this guy put as part of an exhibit, please. Likewise, Richard Rauschenberg exhibited what he called erased de Kooning etching. He got an etching by an artist named de Kooning and erased it and presented that as an artwork, and the art world would now say, yep, that's a work of art. And then, as many of you know, John Cage produced something called 4 minutes and 33 seconds of complete silence, now considered a musical composition, or at least a work of art. Please. So what sort of lessons can we gain from that? Well, first of all, classic works of conceptual art like Duchamp's urinal, Rauschenberg's erased de Kooning etching, Cage's 4 minutes and 33 seconds show us that technical skill in the creation of an artifact is not required for that artifact to be a work of art. And likewise, being an artifact whose creation requires great skill don't have to be works of art necessarily. So those two are related concepts, but neither one presupposes the other. And being an artwork is a social category, I would say. Someone like being a knight, or at least in modern, if not medieval times, or being a CPA. You can have great accounting skills, but you're not a CPA unless you've been designated a CPA by the appropriate body. Please. Thus, two artifacts can be perceptibly indistinguishable. While one's an artwork, and the other one's not. Please. In the absence of institutional conventions, there's no question whether something really is a work of art, any more than whether someone really is a CPA. It's a matter of what society deems it to be. Please. And notice also that on this institutional approach to art, I'm defending what's known as the institutional theory of art, something's being a work of art does not even suggest that it's high in aesthetic or other artistic value. It could be thoroughly mediocre. I would not make a special trip, I would not go to see Duchamp's urinal on grounds of artistic or aesthetic interest. The only reason I'd go to see Duchamp's urinal is because of his historical interest. Please. And so that leaves aside the question of evaluation of artworks. Notice that in contemporary English, the phrase work of art often does convey praise. That, you know, that souffle you made was a work of art, suggested it was really, really good. But that's only suggested, not guaranteed by the meaning of the words. Given the institutional theory, there's no guarantee here at all that a work of art is going to be worth our attention, please. So here's an example of a work from the Museum of Bad Art in Boston. If anybody's wanted to check out Boston while here in this part of the country, from Texas, for example, you can go to MoBA and check out some astonishingly bad works of art. The works of art, they're just awful. Please. So then what does artistic excellence consist in? What makes something a great work of art? That's a topic of huge debate in aesthetics, as I'm sure you can imagine. But it's going to include things like skill, innovation, including busting out of traditional genres and perhaps creating a new one, beauty, sublimity. I would distinguish between the sublime and the beautiful. epistemic value and contribution to an ongoing conversation, and also a romantic idea of emanation of a soul. That's sort of something that's in the back of many of our minds when we think about evaluating works of art. Please. So when you look at a statue of Beethoven, that is a paradigm example of why many people have been so moved by Beethoven, because they feel, and historically many people who wrote about Beethoven's music said, I feel like I'm in touch with a great soul that's somehow speaking to me. Please. Likewise, fantastic artists like Thelonious Monk, there's reasons why he's fantastic, not just as a performer, but also as a composer. Again, please. I'm just saying the same thing as I did before. Go ahead, please. Jussi Björling, the extraordinarily gifted performer, vocalist, again. Miles Davis, and this is fine. Miles Davis, fantastic musician, well, for all kinds of reasons, many of which have to do with the criteria that I mentioned before. And then one of my more relatively contemporary bands, Radiohead, would be one of my favorites. And I could try to give reasons why. They're not just producing musical works of art, they're also producing outstanding musical works of art according to some of the criteria that I gave above. So we want to keep in mind the question, is it work of art, distinguishing that from the question, is it good or great, and if so, what makes it good or great? Please. Likewise, we do want to think about the way in which technology has a long reach. And as T.J. Broy mentioned in a talk that he gave just yesterday, just yesterday, technology has for a long time threatened the work of artists. So 180 years ago, something like that, photography came as a threat to painting. Here's a daguerreotype from, I think, the 1840s that many artists saw and said, oh my gosh, it's going to put us out of business. I don't think it did. But then again, people don't, as often as they used to, go to have their family portraits taken by painters. If they have their family portraits taken, it's going to be by photographers, generally speaking. There are exceptions to that, but painting hasn't died as a result of the inception of photography. Please. Likewise, getting into the musical case, drum machines threatened drummers, and I guess they continue to do so. But I'm not sure that we want to say drum machines are things we should regret the presence of. They've just allowed us to be more explicit about how we appreciate human drumming as opposed to mechanical drumming here. Likewise, sampling came as a threat to music 40 years ago, something like that, when it became particularly popular. Here's an example of The Verve, a band that tried to sample earlier work by other artists and got in big trouble for doing so, and is yet to, I think, earn a penny from the royalties of a very good song they came up with. And now AI seems to threaten nearly all of music. What can we say about that? Please. Go ahead. So playing around with some of the ways in which I might go about producing some music and the help of artificial intelligence, I've come across a couple of different formats. One, for example, is Loudly. I can go onto Loudly and get probably without a subscription, but if I get a subscription, I can get more. I can do more. I can get my music on top sites like Spotify and Apple Music by just typing in various criteria that I want my music to conform to. I want it to be dark. I want it to be evocative. I want it to be one of the many genres of techno, for example, create something that sounds okay, and presumably I could send it off and maybe get some royalties off of it. Please, Aaron. And I could likewise, Suno not only allows you to choose various sorts of songs, you can actually have it make lyrics for you according to the criteria that you lay down. So you can spend some enjoyable, perhaps upsetting or shocking time on YouTube and so forth, finding various creators who make things like artificially intelligence-generated music, bless you, in ways that just conform to the various criteria that they lay down, either by typing in text or by choosing things on a menu, please. So what can we say about AI-generated music now or what's going to be coming up soon? I'm loath to make strong predictions more than a couple months into the future, but I'll try to say a little bit about that, please. It seems to be gaining traction for use as background for videos, podcasts, feature films, and the like. If you're trying to make a podcast, for example, you might save yourself a lot of time and money by just dialing in on Suno various criteria that you wanted to satisfy as you get some background tracks for the intro or the outro for your podcast session and so forth. Perhaps I could earn money by using Suno to create music available on Spotify or something. Maybe I should try it someday. I don't know. Or I could tell Suno, make me a punk pop song about disappointment and loss as I head downstairs to my pain cave for my morning workout. Might not be such a bad thing if I'm getting tired of the music that I've been listening to before. And as I say, Suno even gives you lyrics, please. And who knows, society might deem compositions that are created by AI-generated music to be works of art. There's no in principle barrier to that. It's a matter of what the society deems this kind of material to be. Please. Either way, they might have some aesthetic value. For example, you can dial in. You can actually choose various criteria as you're, when you're creating AI music, like spooky or campy, glamorous, soulful, sexy, dark. Those are all things you can lay down as your aesthetic features that you want your music to have. And sure enough, it'll serve up precisely music that conforms to those characteristics pretty well. Please. Go ahead. It's harder to see how such music could be great. Consider, for instance, the innovation required to create a new musical genre, or then this is one symptom of greatness. Please go ahead. I'm going to give a little kind of argument, as philosophers like to do. Creating a new genre requires insight. What kind of insight? Well, presumably insight that certain extant genres limit us in certain ways. There are things we'd like to be able to do that the genres that exist thus far don't allow us to do, and we want to try something else. So consider the literary genre of new journalism that became well-known in the late 1950s, early 1960s, when writers like Truman Capote said, I'd like to be able to write a book that is based on fact as much as possible, but when it comes to filling in some details, I want to be able to extemporize or to fill in with things that I don't know to be true but may well be true. And so it occupies an interesting space between fiction and nonfiction. I required an insight to come up with that. Go ahead. But insight's a high-level cognitive and or experiential achievement. It requires an understanding of what limitations of the genres are already and an awareness of a realization of what you might do instead that would require changing some of the rules. And there's no currently available, so far as I know, no currently available or technologically feasible machine that can attain such sophistication. By technologically feasible machine, something we can reasonably imagine being created within the next maybe 10 or 15 years, short of an astonishing, incredibly ingenious innovation by on the part of a creator. Please. Therefore, no feasible AI-generated music will achieve greatness, at least by creating a new genre. Go ahead. You can reformulate this argument to apply to other ways in which music could achieve greatness, such as emanation of a soul, contributing to a conversation, being sublime, etc. So this just applies to the case of genre busting, but you can see how to take this line of thought and reformulate it so that it applies to these other important aesthetic criteria that are among the things we point to when we say that's what makes Miles Davis great, for example. Please. A human user could use an AI music generator to produce a piece that is, by happy accident, genre busting. So I might dial in something, and then by accident, I might come across it. It might produce something that is, as a matter of fact, innovative in the sense of not conforming to any extant genre, but doing a good job in some way. But that innovation would be in the users realizing this fact, not in the creation of the piece itself. So the innovation is the user sitting around on a Sunday afternoon saying, wait, whoa. I just created something new because I dialed in various criteria into my machine, and now it just gave me something that actually doesn't conform into any genre that we know about, and I'd like to sort of present it and share it with people and see whether it gets some uptake. And if so, the creator, the human creator, deserves credit for that realization, not the machine. Please. So well, let me sum up. Being a work of art is one thing. Being a good or great work of art is quite another. Artistic excellence may be achieved in any of several ways. I tried to lay down some of the criteria. It's not meant to be an exhaustive list at all. I'm sure you can think of others that are part of what makes a work of art great. Doing so, that is achieving artistic excellence, requires high-level cognitive or affective or conative types of features that we don't find in currently feasible machines. I mean, machines that are available now or that could feasibly be created within the next 15 or so years. Or you could create these things with good luck on the part of the creator, the human creator, as long as there's a human being able to realize that something new has been done. Until something changes here, we can welcome using artificial intelligence generated music for more mundane activities like earning money or throwing parties, etc. And the competition that this technology creates may actually spur human creators to be more daring. To try to come up with something more original. Human drummers can do things that drum machines can't do, and hopefully that'll be the case for a long time. Even if they can't drum as fast as machine drummers can, they can do other things that have considerable aesthetic value. And likewise, composers and performers of music can and probably will continue to do for a long time things that machines can't. And my hope is that when they find themselves, as they will inevitably will, already have done, having to compete with AI-generated music, they will thereby be able to accentuate what's special about human artifacts, such as works of music and performances thereof. And I think that's what I've got to say. Thank you very much.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. And let me introduce you to a terrific new podcast series, A Sense of Rebellion. A Sense of Rebellion is a captivating new 10-part podcast from Yevgeny Morozov and our friends at Post Utopia and The Syllabus. A decade in the making, it began as a doctoral dissertation featuring a score by Brian Eno. That's right, Brian Eno. The podcast explores a forgotten yet fascinating countercultural project at the dawn of the digital revolution. From LSD and the Rockefellers to AI and the CIA, each episode blends drama, mystery, and meticulous archival research. Don't miss out on A Sense of Rebellion, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Cool. As Dr. Jeffrey Ogbar said, my name is Aaron Dial. I am a postdoctoral research fellow at Purdue University and an incoming professor at Colgate University in film and media studies and Africana and Latin American studies. Professors like to give, or universities like to give professors long titles. I don't know why. But yeah, so I'm excited to be here and talk to you about rapping robots, particularly how rapping robots and our sort of, as Mitch said, our culture intelligence around AI sort of really sort of exposes a lot of sort of interesting sort of racial logics with sort of capitalism and just music in general. So, is being a human still a prerequisite for being an artist? In his April 2021 critique, journalist Murray Stassen presented this interrogative to frame his thoughts on the popularity and existential fact of FN Mecca, the then popular robot rapper. Show of hands, has anybody heard of FN Mecca before? One, have you heard the song Florida Water or Moonwalking? It's really popular on TikTok for like a second. Okay, this guy gets it. Okay, cool. As I begin, that white folks invented a rapping, dancing robot programmed to mime, embodied, and vocal black rhythms and sound without paying black people when actual black people brought the robot to music masses is an irony definitely not lost on me and shouldn't be ignored by you. For me, though, FN Mecca's presence and Stassen's question, while indeed an entry point for this presentation, directs our thinking not merely to the perplexing what-the-fuckness of FN Mecca's existence, but a collision of past and futures exposing capitalism's unyielding effort to target blackness as prime mineral deposit. A prime and original deposit for extraction. FN Mecca isn't just an inevitably fleeting example of aural digitized kitsch. Its robotic and programmatic unaliveness, its thing power, matters. In fact, how the logics of the Middle Passage and plantation slavery did and continue to roboticize black people is the whole damn point. Race is, writes Hannah Arendt, not the beginning of humanity, but its end. Not the natural birth of man, but his unnatural death. Both the politics of robots and race instrumentalize, pun intended, death. But, and this is my main question, could they do anything else? In vibrant manner, Jane Bennett exclaims, not flower power or black power or girl power, but thing power, the curious ability of inanimate things to animate, to act, to produce effects dramatic and subtle. In response, Armin Town's work deeply considers the racial material consequences of Bennett's material philosophy as well, given Bennett's thesis, her oddly humanist smudging of history, and who was afforded the privilege of humanity. And I'm going to quote Towns at length here. Thing power proposes that matter is just as vibrant as humans of all races. And if thing power is not black power, then her assumption is that the call for black power is an essentially human call that is also to be read as consistent with Western historical distinctions between humans and matter. However, black power is a response to the historical construct of the black body, that which has been treated in ways suggesting a consistency with dead objects. Both are things that lack self-determination. How is thing power not black power if black bodies are historically thought of as things? Black power describes an organizing agenda of voter registration and political organization popularized by the Black Panthers. Moreover, as insurgent and apparatic counterhistory, black power demands the material exploitation of black people through the Atlantic slave trade be read as a foundational element of American prosperity. Put otherwise, to say black folks built this country, while true, denudes the clarity of that truth where blackness laboring as hands and expended as rebar, initiates the reality of American prominence and fiction of the American dream. In this moment, I don't wish to simply rearticulate Towns, but extend his work to consider something he does not, that just as gasoline powers the automobile, a materially exploited and fabricated thingified blackness TM powers the material vibrancy of F.N. Mecca's robotic existence. I'm concerned with integration, not busing and school systems or workplaces and neighborhoods, mind you, but platform integration. Integration, as it always has, portends a frictionless contact between whiteness and the black other, where imperialism charges a fee for the privilege of accessing what has already been looted. In the case of F.N. Mecca, difference demonstrates not the cultural production of a liberated people, but the cultural fabrication of digitized and corporately owned automatons. Innovation, then, which I express as the seamless transition and translation of race data, elides the white guilt stemming from the recreational longing for cultural imperialism, not with necessary and important work of confronting privilege and power, but through eliminating the source, black people, from the signal, black culture. That is, the logic goes, if I can't rap nigga, I'll build a robot that can. And F.N. Mecca rap nigga a lot. F.N. Mecca and its creators sample blackness as an innovative modality of American capitalist plunder, where in the place of drum machines and breakbeats are digitized vocoded tissue samples. Now it seems would be an important, appropriate point to, as any, to provide some definitional specificity to sampling, or at least how I'm implementing the term. To start, sampling necessarily describes scientific, quantified, and technologically gathered methods of extraction. Being a representative subset of a whole, samples approximate larger populations. Its extraction almost always feeds into the technologized apparatus and institution of scientific knowledge production. That is, being specimens, samples are taken to further scientific discovery, both great and small. Here, think about everything from air samples, which reveal pollutants and mold particulates, to urine and soil samples. Black dissection built the world as an all-forgotten archive of samples, spanning the unnamed corpses of the enslaved to the stolen helogene of Henrietta Lacks, a macabre collection and curation of exhumed remains and living cadavers, skulls, bones, skins, limbs, and fingers, penises, breasts, and asses. Think of Sarah Bartman here, who is depicted in this cartoon. Humanity, in its pursuit of discovery, has killed and maimed and raped and polluted. It has ended more worlds than we can count. Undeniably, black rigor mortis orders the rigor and wonder of science. We must remember blackness here, specifically referring to darkness of complexion, was once considered humankind's innervating poison resulting from the curse of Ham. This biblical origin of skin color entrenches the matters of black and white within a Christian and Western scheme of good and evil. During the periods of the Scientific Revolution and the Age of Enlightenment, as culture and people distance itself from unquestioning religiosity and look to science and human philosophy to be known, researchers across various fields during the early 17th century and beyond were obsessed with diagnosing the black African's corporeal liabilities, its negre or negritude. Scholars of the era and beyond quite literally picked the bones and peeled the flesh of black bodies to find this fluke, which they thought perverted whiteness's presumed naturality. In fact, melanin, everyone's here heard of melanin? Cool. The skin pigment produced in the epidermis's basal layer was discovered by Marcello Malpighi, that guy. Was discovered when Marcello Malpighi used a corrosive chemical agent to putrefy the skin of Ethiopian cadavers. That's one of his drawings. Indeed, they looked for and found dark scales, brains, and bile, as if any other outcome was possible. Found here shouldn't be read as validating their discoveries, but demonstrating the sheer power of white supremacy to make up the world as it sees fit. The seed of color, as it was called in Searching for the Origin of Race, was found because white supremacy deemed its finding necessary. This historical anecdote is a mere digression. Instead, it begins our inquiry into F.N. Mecca, well, at the beginning. Stassen's questions finds odd F.N. Mecca as mere technologized happening. He asks whether F.N. Mecca is real fake or fake real, and to address his question directly, the answer is simple. F.N. Mecca is a deep fake. The United States Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs defines deepfakes as being an emergent type of threat falling under the greater and more pervasive umbrella of synthetic media. utilizing a form of artificial intelligence, machine learning, to create believable, realistic videos, pictures, audios, and audio and text of events which never happen. However, I interpret FMECA's artifice as crucially being the sum of an imperial project to innovate plunder as primary colonial modus operandi. The indeed perplexing technical specificity of that definition is woefully impotent to consider FMECA's digitized fabrication of Black culture and music, as well as the techno-scientific origins of Blackness. For myself and Malpigi, I'll be in drastically divergent ways. The always already assumption of Black flesh, or its existence as the OG synthetic medium, produces Blackness as eternal quarry where innumerable lacerations dig to find the captive body's irresistible sensuality. Here, fake or synthetic do not just synonymize fabrication, but point to a centuries-long endeavor where Black birth canals manufacture decimated, partially formed, three-fifths to be exact, Black men and women as not human beings, but roasted homunculi. Linking FMECA's creation to a centuries-old search for negritude isn't to just answer Stassen's provocative question. Instead, I advance this link as a program of white colonial capitalist plunder, where the display of Black sampling, regardless if that sample is fleshed or sonic, living or dead, as lens for what we see as a unique innovation of capitalism, where the profit potential of exploiting Blackness no longer requires the Black body. As opposed to asking about the human prerequisite for making art, I interrogate the Western corporatized desire of spectacularizing Blackness, as well as the economic viability of separating Blackness from its once thought inseparable essence. From here on, I'll just call it this NESS. This technologized spectacle produces that itching, you know it when you see it, yet equally and nebulous and esoteric NESS, which stands behind the Black as it does right there. In moving NESS to the fore, the wondrous spectacle of Black cultural production and aesthetics, a near endless mixtape of bodies, sounds, listening practices, and technologies become elastic, stretched on a corporate torture rack of constant consumption, not for mere scientific or technical curiosity. As if that wasn't strange enough, this process isolates and even severs NESS through a digital alchemy of robots and algorithms, producing a stable commodity of negriness, or as I am naming it, the perfectly brandable and endlessly reproducible Blackness TM. It appears capitalism, with its endless propensity to innovate, has finally figured out how to sell Blackness without the problem and liability of Black people. With this understanding, this presentation interrogates the futuristic seeming thinginess of FMECA, not marveling at its novelty as Stassen and others do, but considering how the original sin and anti-naturalness of Blackness has been platformed quite literally in our current age of algorithm and AI. As perverse irony, through white capitalism's continual search for profit, FMECA samples Blackness, treating it as necessary material cog in the production of popular music. The background company behind the creation of FMECA is Factory New, which was led by Anthony Martini, this guy, a music executive. He used to manage or be a part of the management team of Justin Bieber, I think. So I guess to make him, I guess, a little more relevant to folks. And Brandon Lee, a video game artist, before it dissolved in August 2022. On the creation of Mecca, Martini says, not to get off philosophical, how many artists are just vessels for commercial endeavors? Think about it. The virtual likeness of an artist, it doesn't get old, it doesn't get angry, it doesn't argue with you. His comments, which I imagine were stated in that unmistakable timbre of tech bro arrogance, make no effort to hide the real innovation behind FMECA, not as an artist, but as technology, and that's bondage. FMECA is a deepfake where the artifice isn't the presentation of reality or authentic personhood, but Blackness is being a singular mechanism for absenting personhood. To quote Neda Antanasovsky and Kalindi Vora in Surrogate Humanity, it is implicitly anti-racist because it's human-free. Moreover, through the theorization of techno-liberalism, the political alibi of present-day racial capitalism that posits the scholars' present imaginaries of techno-scientific freedom, where innovation, quote, liberates human potential that has always been defined in relation to degraded and devalued others and produces a better human life that tends to be limited by prior racial and gendered imaginaries of what kinds of tasks separate the human from the less than or not quite human other. So for example, what they're talking about here is, for example, like back during the antebellum period, white folks would say, I am more human, or I am human, than my black counterparts because I don't have to be a slave. So they're talking about saying that they made the differentiation apart from human to non-human, from black to white, through the labor of slavery. So that's sort of a short version of that. Those same logics that made black bodies ripe for theft offer the liberal human subject the ability to explore the white humanist aspirations of conquest, subjugation, and profit. Better put, the objectivity of it all is the point. That blackness can or should be extracted to prop up profit concerns links it to the dehumanizing notions of science and mathematics, think eugenics and physiognomics, but in place of measuring skulls as hit records and infectious danceable song construction. At stake here is undoubtedly freedom, the freedom of corporations to sample without fear of human consequence, to find a never-ending, always ready, willing, able, and docile surrogate for labor, and to push aside, maybe forever, the annoying prospect of talent acquisition and retention. For Martini, humanity represents the exploitive, cumbersome levers of labor and modernity. Who wants to pay workers when building them is possible? Moreover, to him, the music industry's future and who can access humanity's privileges there within balance on race as a fulcrum. Furthermore, F and Mecca specifically, and Factory New, Martini and Lee, and the music industry more generally, cast a long shadow redacting the humanity of black people, art, and makers. They see, like other industries, the existence of blackness as being computational, a mathematical ingredient easily targeted and imitated. In other words, generations of musical practice and art are shrunk to the infinitesimal and infinite scale of algorithms. The consequence of this is a future where black music blooms again without black people. As of now, a human voice performs the vocals, explains Martini, but we are working towards the ability to have a computer come up with and perform its own words and even collaborate with other computers as co-writers. His words, again, read in that putrid, musky, and grandiose lilt, speak to an always networked, never human artistry, basically if Hype Williams directed Blade Runner. Moreover, their neon pixelated future, pulsing with 808s and the menacing snares of trap music, contemplates a musical reality where the ontology of black voices represents an acousmatic fiction where the voice's inability to be truly unique yields the unlimited possibility of profit. Essentially, more than any singular artists living or virtual or something in between, Factory News innovation goes beyond F and Mecca. Their hopes were to build and ultimately monetize a library of vocal fonts inked emphatically in black. But I stated earlier, there is a human behind F and Mecca, and that person is this guy, Houston, Texan-based rapper Kyle the Hooligan. The rapper's posted social media detailing the working conditions of his time as the voice behind F and Mecca took down F and Mecca and his parent company, Factory New. Basically, they said they were going to pay him, and they didn't pay him. Before he came forward, the company was poised for success, having inked a lucrative deal, I think it was around the seven figures, with Capitol Records, and two of its singles, as I talked about earlier, Moonwalking and Florida Water. Kyle the Hooligan's exploitation exposed the perniciousness of objectivity. But the appropriation of black music isn't new. White folks treated jazz clubs during the Harlem Renaissance and Safari Adventures, and before that, the soul of Negro spirituals was often delocalized and offered up to national and global flows of capital as a way of imbricating it in mainstream popular culture. And indeed, probability of white pleasure through encountering American popular music confrontation of race. For scores of white Americans at the turn of the 20th century, the first time seeing a black man in a suit were jazz musicians advertising various things in music magazines. In the case of photographic technology, and for that matter, the suit as a sartorial technology, signifying not just class but civilization itself, produced a new way of seeing black people. As such, through technologization, the black body as tribal reflection of white's pre-civilized past became early idiom and practical test case for our post-human, cybernetic, and virtual present and future. The content of black music, not just its oral character, but its technical production and dissemination of sound, pasteurized the modern age for white America, keeping them and black folks too, I must add, sane and satiated amid the changing and accelerating tempo of capitalist technocentric progress. In this way, jazz music emulated train sounds and factory whistles. jazz music emulate train sounds and factory whistles. Berry Gordy sequenced the Motown sounds to Detroit assembly line rhythms. And Michael Jackson literally broadcast the robot to the American zeitgeist when he performed the dance on television to the Jackson 5 hit Dancing Machine. Black rhythms and sound literally step into the future. Epic Mecca's algorithmic existence imagines a damning future of black music's digital and virtual extraction. Now to conclude, let us turn our attention to how algorithms, that's algo, R-H-Y-T-H-M-S, as a scratch, ruptures this mainstream digital status quo, challenging, reversing, and sometimes even stopping, if only for a moment, the relation of capitalist time and power. Black as a sound is a way of being black, exclaims Catherine McKittrick, and being black is an orally aesthetic way of life. Here, the interplay of impulse and tradition looping through the momentary and timeless is essential. When swift agile fingers dance along jog wheels and vinyl turntables, twisting knobs and sliding levers, we hear it as vibes and always fly. Brush the dirt off your shoulders, transgression and revolt against empire's demand for incarceration within the cells of ordered grids. Black folks were never off the record. We sum life and living after and between the record. Thank you.
All right. My name is Dustin Ballard. I'm an advertising creative director in Dallas and a musician on the side. And a few years ago, I sort of stumbled into the world of social media content creation through a channel I started called There I Ruined It. So this started back during the pandemic. My band wasn't playing out. And in a moment of musical boredom, I sort of had this random idea one night to, what if I took a music video, but I completely replaced all of the audio with my own singing, my own instruments, changed the chord structure, the melody, everything about the song, except for lining up the lips with a lyric. So it gave this, gave the appearance of the singer performing in a totally wrong genre. So my first experiment with this was with the song Shallow from A Star Is Born with Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper. And I turned it into a polka duet. And so I kind of put this together. It was kind of funny, so I threw it up on YouTube. I actually didn't even have a YouTube channel. I just started one for that video, and I called it There I Ruined It. And it got like 100,000 views that first night, and so I just sort of kept making these things. They had Michael Jackson singing bluegrass, Kurt Cobain singing swing, just kind of mixing these up in these kind of absurd ways. Eventually, I took this to TikTok and Instagram, and it kind of blew up even more. These things were getting millions of views, and this just became sort of my strange evening hobby after I put the kids to bed. So just to give you an idea of what these songs sounded like before AI came along, I'll show you an example here. This is my Oktoberfest edition of Straight Outta Compton. My apologies.
I'm about to witness the strength of street knowledge.
Sorry about that. So fast forward to about a year ago, like everyone else, I started hearing about all this AI in the news and immediately saw the potential for what I was doing. The channel was always about creating this kind of alternate universe where the artists you know were singing in the wrong genre. And so the chance to have AI add this whole new level of believability to that seemed really fun to me. But I had no idea how to do that or how to even begin. I knew nothing about the process. Eventually, I ran into a guy at work who knew a guy who knew another guy down in Argentina that was making these AI voice models. So we jumped on a Zoom call together. And long story short, he created a Frank Sinatra AI voice model for me. So I took that model. I did my best Frank Sinatra impersonation. And out came Frank Sinatra singing Get Low by Little John, which I'll play for you in a minute. Again, my apologies. Pretty quickly, I learned how to create these AI voice models myself. I'll get into that a little later as well. And it just became one of several tools that I used and that I still use to, quote unquote, ruin music. Before I get any further, I thought I'd just play a sampling of some of the AI songs that I've created over the past year. Quite a ride. So the response to these AI remixes has been, among the fans, very positive. Even Little John liked it. Questlove says, I should not be laughing this hard at 1 a.m. So the fans liked it. The record labels, however, not so much. Many of the songs you just saw were stricken from the internet. I got more copyright strikes than I can count and takedowns. And it got so bad, particularly from Universal Music Group, that I had to take my YouTube channel down for 3 months just to let all these strikes expire so I didn't get a permanent ban. I could give a whole other presentation on how YouTube makes it virtually impossible to overturn a strike based on parody and fair use, which should be protecting a lot of these songs. But basically, they can't afford to upset the labels, so they do whatever the labels say. This was always a little bit of an issue with the channel, but after I started doing these AI remixes, like, I saw this sharp uptick in these sorts of issues. My assumption is that the record labels are threatened by AI, and I'm sure somewhere on a wall at UMG is the There I Ruined It logo as part of their most wanted list. So amidst all of this, on February 2nd, I learned that they had actually kicked off a congressional hearing by playing one of my Johnny Cash remixes. It was a hearing on the dangers of AI music.
Robots should not be subject to free speech.
For the record, I am not a robot, but I think his comments are kind of reflective of this misconception that AI music, you just type a few things in a computer and this finished product comes out. When I do get criticisms online for using AI, it's almost always along the lines of how lazy it is. Like, I wish you'd just go back to making real music instead of letting the computers do everything. So I just don't think there's a basic understanding of how any of this works. A few weeks ago, I had a fan request to hear my voice before the AI was added. So I thought I would take that chance to do a series of before and after clips. So I did a post that was just short little snippets of some of the channel's greatest hits to show people kind of how it worked. And so I'll play that for you real quick. Santa cannot lie. So I posted that just thinking it would be kind of a fun, peek behind the curtain and might interest some people. But I was actually shocked at how surprised people were that there was like somebody singing these, like there was more to the process than just typing this into a computer. There's still the arranging and mix and instruments and the vocal imitation and all of these things. Like, I still have to get it 90% of the way there. This is just one extra step at the end to add to that believability. So let's talk about that step. How does this work? As a caveat, I don't know anything about the programming or the back end of how any of this works. I can just kind of tell you the steps involved. But it starts with training the model. This is RVC, retrieval-based voice conversion, is what most people use. And what this requires is like clean vocal samples. So you could get a studio vocal track. A lot of these are just available on YouTube. Or you can isolate your own vocals, and you can use that as the input. And it really doesn't require that much material. I've made pretty decent voice models with as little as like a minute of sample. So there's this kind of convoluted process that's not very user-friendly at the moment, and you kind of go through it, and at the end you have this basically zip file that's your voice model. After this, there's a process called inferencing, which is where you take the input, which is in my case usually my own singing, and you run that through the voice model. There are different parameters where you can kind of dial in the sound you want and experiment with what sounds the most realistic. And then you go back and swap that into your mix and you have your final piece. There's also this kind of underworld of Discord where people will post their own voice models that they've made. These tend to be a lot of anime characters and K-pop stars that I've never heard of, so I don't spend a lot of time in this world. I usually just make my own so I can control the quality of it. And that's the process in a nutshell. So I'll end with kind of my two cents on AI music, at least the way I'm using it. I know this is just one little subset. We haven't talked about AI to generate lyrics and compositions and imitate styles. There's a lot of ways you can use it. But basically, I'm not pro AI. I'm not anti AI. Like, I get a lot of the issues and dangers. I'm in agreement with most of what was said at that congressional hearing about artists needing some control over their likeness. However, I think there's already a lot of laws on the book about this. Like, I can't just take Elvis and use him to sell cheeseburgers or something. Like, there's already rules that prevent that. However, I am allowed to make Elvis parodies. I am allowed to be an Elvis impersonator if I want to do that as a profession. Like, there's allowances for parody. So to me, a blanket ban of AI voices would kind of be like banning Photoshop, just because it could be used to mislead people, right? I think you have to allow parody, and you know, nobody bats an eye when The Onion creates a photoshopped image of a celebrity doing something ridiculous, no matter how realistic it is, because we're okay with that from a visual standpoint. I feel like in a lot of ways, AI is just the audio equivalent of that, and we just have to kind of get used to it and understand the context of whatever you're seeing. Another issue I'll bring up is AI replacing musicians. As a musician, that's a little scary and a little depressing, and I think whatever we do, that's bound to happen at some point. I'm sure it's already happening. However, I'll make the point that I think it could also work both ways. If you think about auto-tune, for example, whatever you think about auto-tune, it had this kind of democratizing effect where it allowed people that maybe weren't trained singers to put out an album and to express themselves creatively. So in that sense, it allowed more musicians to come out of the woodwork. And in some ways, AI can work the same way. You can imagine having a bank of voices to choose from to kind of express yourself in different ways that fit whatever your idea is in your head. I'm not talking about celebrity voices, but just we'll call them stock AI voices. Not altogether different from the fact that as a guitarist, I can pick up one of 100 guitars and get a slightly different sound to better express what I'm doing. And you know, we don't think twice about that as instrumentalists. But when it comes to your voice, there's this sense that, well, you have your one voice, you have to use that. And in some way, that seems a little unfair to me. So there's all this to say there's good and there's bad. At its best, I think AI is a creative tool used to make music better. At its worst, it becomes just a tool of efficiency that really only benefits the labels to make more money. I think what's going to happen is probably a little bit of both. And, you know, interesting times ahead. Don't know where things are going to go, but I'm just trying to have some fun along the way. So thank you very much.